Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Bringing you more stories from the African Synod in particular. Two Sudanese bishops share with me their impressions. And then I'll be telling you the story of Li Mateu, or Matteo Ricci. Thanks so much for joining me once again. This month, the Second General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops for Africa took up much of our time here at Vatican Radio. But while most of the over 200 bishops who attended have now flown back to their nations, Africa is still in our hearts and minds. Yes, Africa has left its mark, in our memories, but also in our recordings. I thought we'd begin today by listening to one of these recordings, a witness to the faith of one Sudanese bishop, whom I believe has now returned home, home to a nation where there is persecution of Christians. He's the Auxiliary Bishop of Khartoum, Daniel Marco Kur Adwok. How do you reconcile this violence there is in your country with the existence of God? Is God in Sudan?
Oh yes, there is God in Sudan. Oh, there is God, there is God. 23 years of civil war. We have walked with our people. We have walked with our people. They have known through the different Eucharistic celebrations in public squares. They knew that we spiritual leaders, we bishops, we were powerless. And they knew that the only strength that can keep them going and continuing to witness their Christian faith was the strength in God, in their faith. It came out very, very, very strongly in the Christians who were there, who are now in the Sudan. Their faith in God keeps them alive. And you get that from the very, very marginalized, very poor people who maybe today will not have anything to eat at home, but neither will he go or she go and sell her faith away because she slept angry. So I think it is from there that we begin our journey to search for justice in our country. It is from our faith. We will not abandon it.
There is a church in Sudan.
There is a church in Sudan, yeah. It's a poor church, but it is a church that is alive. The servant of God, Pope John Paul II, told the Cardinal Zubair, who was the Archbishop of Khartoum, when he climbed a high place to view the people who came to meet him in 1993. He told Cardinal Zubair, he said, "Look, I thought these people would be afraid and hiding, but these people, they frighten you." You see, and then he said, yes, I mean, these people, they really do frighten. I mean, they have faith.
They frighten you in a good sense.
They frighten you in a good sense. I mean, you really feel that they are not afraid of anything. They profess their faith and openly and without looking even behind that there is any danger at all.
You were listening there to the Auxiliary Bishop of Khartoum, Daniel Marco Kur Adwok, the tallest bishop at the synod as far as I could see, who introduced me to another fellow bishop from his nation, one to witness persecution of Christians in a special way in his diocese, the Diocese of Tombura Yambio in southern Sudan. His name is Edward Hiboro Kusala, and in August, among the ongoing violence, he witnessed the crucifixion of Christians. I thought I'd ask him, given his personal experience, what kind of relevance the synod discussions focusing around reconciliation justice and peace could possibly have for him at all.
Yeah, this synod to me has been a moment of reflection, a self-conversion, and a moment of coming to terms with the realities in which I live. I come from a country that has a long history of violence, and me personally lost my mom when I was just 2 months old in the same violence. So she was murdered. She was murdered by military people. So I have taken upon myself many years before interest of resolving and working for peace. So this synod has been an opportunity for me as such to re-examine my attitude towards promotion of peace and knowing the fact that I have to come to terms really with what I have lived through, the pain, the suffering, the despair. I've worked with that, I've lived with that, and I have to accept it. The topic is difficult. Reconciliation is not a simple thing, it's a process. And the real issue is it needs a space. It needs a place where one can be able to come to terms with himself or herself in order to say, yes, this is my story. Things have gone wrong, things have spoiled, but I still can make a new step. And looking at the same way, this the same for me and for any other Africans, we look at our history, how much we have been humiliated by history, by many things, but we still see this is not the end. There's still a victory. We look at Christ on the cross. He did not remain on the cross. Behind the cross, there is victory, there is joy. So this is a moment for us to convert ourselves and be able to walk out of what has happened in our history and be able to work for betterment of the country, of the continent from which we come. And I think we are also challenged to take it seriously as a part of our apostolate, this work for peace. Because we indeed become the children of God. We need to take it as our daily pastoral work wherever we are. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's what actually I've been trying to do, to spread the spirit of reconciliation and putting in place justice and peace. The real difficulty with this is we are going to work with people who do not understand this language, who do not even believe that what they are doing is just their duty. There's nothing wrong with it. Who will not even be able to listen to us or to me, who will not see me as an equal, who don't see that talking about a reconciliation with someone who's different, maybe from a different religion, different ethnic group, he is a minor person, he's just a lower person. I can't equal up talking to such a person. This is the challenge we are going to find. But of course, it is a duty that we must work to build peace in Sudan. And that's a work we have to take as a church, I have to take as people of Sudan, to work to build a reconciliation in our country. And the other thing, of course, is also to advocate on our behalf with people of other communities, the friends of Africa, the Europeans, the Arabs, the Asians. We need to capture what can bring peace in Africa. We need respect for ourselves as Africans by promoting good governance and respect for common good and for human life. We also to expect that from our brothers and sisters. Some of them humiliated us so much in the past. I think it's a moment also for them to convert and be able to help Africa and to work together with Africa to come out of this poverty in which we are living and the conflict that is going on. Because at a certain point, when you look at the conflicts going on within our countries and in our continent, you see the string going all the way out of the continent. There are people who like to sponsor those things, who like to benefit while we are all in confusion. And this is also, this synod has helped us to pass this message to them. And also asking our Christian brothers who believe in the value of human life to insist with their government to respect Africa and be able to have system that can promote this continent so that we live together. I belong to human family, human tribe, and that's what I see for everybody. So I think the future is not desperate. What has been very interesting is that our stories are the same, and I see a lot of strong will to make things work. It's a moment that we need to get in dialogue with ourselves at home. We need to talk to ourselves as Africans. We need to talk to our leaders. We need to talk to those who are in charge to see that we get rid of these problems in Africa. It has been a moment of conversion. We need God in our history. We need to put Christ in our history, in the midst of our own working conditions, so that the world can be purified, the world can be brought to perfection, and peace can be stable in our midst, and we indeed can be called children of God. And that's what we really need to make ourselves salty. We have lost our saltiness, and we need to reinforce it, to be salty and be the true light of the world.
And my thanks there go to the Bishop of Tombura Yambio in southern Sudan, Edward Hiboro Kusala. By the way, should you wish to hear the full interviews from these bishops and others who were at the African Synod, be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. We have a special icon there on our webpage dedicated to the Synod for Africa. And now moving on. At first glance, my two main stories on today's broadcast just don't have a lot in common. Yet the African Synod and an exhibition marking the fourth centenary of the death of the legendary Jesuit Matteo Ricci are linked for me in a trivial way, simply because as I made my way each day after reporting on the Second General Assembly of the Synod for Africa from the Synod Hall to Vatican Radio, I kept on getting caught up with the delivery of exhibits connected to Limateux. One day, I have to confess, I almost tripped up on a large dragon, as the delivery men pointed out, scolding me for this. I have to add, the dragon was all wrapped up, of course. At any rate, the exhibition in question opens to the public on October 30th. It's called To the Heights of History, Matteo Ricci Between Rome and Peking, and it's housed in the Charlemagne wing of the colonnade of St. Peter's Square. That's the colonnade to the left as you look at the basilica itself. But why all the fuss about Matteo Ricci? Who was he exactly? The story begins in Macau, where Ricci arrived 4 centuries ago. It's a place I've been to myself. Closest to China I've ever been is Macau.
So those people walking over there, they're in China now.
Like most people, I reached this port at the mouth of the Pearl River, once known as Oyster Mirror, by boat, crossing the South China Sea. I couldn't help myself from thinking that I was following in the steps of Italian Jesuit, Matteo Ricci, who travelled to this city 4 centuries earlier, when it had only just been made an episcopal see by Pope Gregory XIII in 1582. It was easy for me to imagine him arriving there in the humid subtropical climate to attend what was then the first Western college in the Far East, in an effort to learn the language which would allow him access to China. It was a time of religious ferment for Catholics in Macau, and plans for a great cathedral were being drawn up. The landmark skeleton facade of this cathedral still stands proud today with its grandiose staircase. And indeed, it's a place where Matteo Ricci's name still lingers on to this day. But for Ricci, Macau was only a stepping stone. He was not there to stay and see the cathedral built. His mission was to the Ming court in Peking. And to make things easier, he took a Chinese name, Limateux.
Limateux, yes. I think he got his Chinese name when he arrived in Macau. Because during those years, the Chinese government is always quite suspicious of foreigners. They don't allow foreigners to go in, except just for trade, you know.
Jesuit Father Emmanuel Lim, for many years special assistant to the Jesuit Chinese provincial, now heads Vatican Radio's Chinese program, I asked him to tell me more about Ricci's entry into China. He'd obviously entered cautiously, taking precautions to diffuse suspicions. And not being able to pass as a trader, he thought he'd fare better as a man of the cloth, I'd heard. Was it really true that he'd adopted the garb of a man of the cloth, one which had to be friendly and familiar locally, such as that of the Buddhist monk? And did he and his companion, another Italian Jesuit by the name of Michele Ruggeri, really shave their heads and don the garb of unknown monks?
Yes, it's true. He thought that the Buddhist monks were respected, were treated like the priest in the Western countries in Europe. So that's why he dressed himself as a Buddhist monk.
However, Father Lim told me, Ricci may have been correct in adopting the robes that mark the presence of a man of God, but he adopted the wrong ones. So which were the right ones? Well, those of the Confucian scholar with his ceremonial square bonnet and silk robes. Those drew far more respect at the court.
In China during those times, Buddhist monks did not have high respect from people. The scholars, they are the one who has, people respect them and want to listen to them. So later he changed into dressed like a scholar, Confucian scholar.
But Ricci, who was nicknamed the wise man from the West, had more up his sleeve in his effort to bring Christian religion to the attention of the court of the Chinese emperors. For example, gifts, tangible signs of friendship, from paintings and breviaries to precious stones and sand clocks. I asked Father Lim about this clever ploy to introduce concepts of religion that must have been totally foreign to the emperor in a visual manner.
During those years, the Chinese, they do not know much about the Western world and the culture. You have to show them something tangible, something really different that we have not seen in China. So that interests them, especially brought in the prison. You
know, the prison.
Yeah, prism, yes. Mm. The light when you go through and see the seven colors, like rainbows, and also the clock.
So a mixture of religious objects and
ordinary
sort like, of...
Yeah, so-called technology, those days.
IT.
Yeah, IT, yes, yes.
IT from those years.
Yes.
As Father Lim had brought to my notice how foreign Western culture was to the Chinese in those days, I wondered how foreign Christianity was to them at the beginning of the 17th century. I discovered, to my surprise, that in earlier times, Christians had not been so foreign to the people of this nation. It was at the time of the Mongols.
Before Ming Dynasty began, there was Christianity in China. That was during the Mongolians, they ruled China. And after that, there was a revolution and then they overthrew the Mongolian dynasty. Because during those years, the Mongolians welcomed missionaries from the West. So the Han people thought that Christians, the Catholics, are friends of the Mongolians. So when they overthrew the Mongolians, they threw out everything. They threw out the Catholics too, so, and the Christians. So during those years, during the Ming Dynasty, a Christian is a very small minority. I mean, a few hundreds perhaps in China, especially in Beijing and those years.
But anyway, recapitulating, in answer to my earlier question, by the time Ricci arrived in China, Christianity was largely unknown, something new, something foreign, and therefore suspect.
They're always suspicious of the foreigners. They are coming in to try to conquer China, or, you know, they have this kind of mentality. They are afraid of foreigners, actually.
A diffidence.
They're different, yes. Yeah.
But Ricci had no end of trump cards. As Father Lim mentioned earlier, the Chinese had great respect for scholars. And Ricci, let's not forget this, ranked as one of the most cultivated men of his time, a sort of Renaissance figure, with expertise in a broad range of fields, from maths to astronomy to linguistic expertise. I asked how this played into his hands.
So when he was in Macau, he learned a lot about the Chinese classics. During those years, he really learned about China. That's why he can dress himself as a Mandarin. And when people talk to him, he knows what he's talking about. He knows what to talk to the people about. And
plus, the intellectuals.
Yeah, the intellectuals also. And also with his Western knowledge, with all this new knowledge he brought in, that fascinates the people there, especially well-educated people, Mandarins in China. So that attracts people to him. That's why there are so many well-educated people during those times that approached him. And later, they were converted and they become Catholics, you know, especially like the prime minister during the Ming Dynasty, Guangqi, Xu Guangqi, Paul Xu. He was a minister that time in the court, and his friends also were converted to Christianity.
Certainly these conversions were made easier by Ricci's expert linguistic skills and his hard work at translation of Christian truths into Chinese, such as the Ten Commandments. But I asked Father Lim, can one safely affirm he laid the groundwork for the Chinese to accept Christianity into their culture?
Yes. In fact, during those years, the Jesuits translated even the Mass into Chinese, breviary into Chinese, everything. Jesuits already started to lay this ground.
It seems Ricci laid the groundwork all right, to the extent that over 80 years after his death, for a decade after 1692, the Kangxi Emperor issued an edict granting toleration to the Christian religion. But then two serious stumbling blocks surfaced on the horizon, focusing around the Chinese rite of ancestor worship and public homage to Confucius, pitting on the one hand the Jesuits in Peking and on the other Dominicans and Franciscans who lived in different parts of China.
They were in different parts of China, and the Jesuits were in Beijing, where you find many well-educated Chinese Mandarins. And what they understood about paying respect to the ancestor, that's just a cultural thing. But for the other missionaries who were in the southern part of China, dealing with people who are not well educated, the rural area, and those people, they saw this kind of ceremony, it's like worshipping the ancestor so that the ancestor will protect them.
A controversy which ended up in Rome, where the Pope sided with the Franciscans and the Dominicans, placing a ban on the Chinese ceremonial rite of respect of ancestors, enforced by his nuncio.
During the Qing Dynasty, nuncio who came from Rome, he was responsible to tell the people, all the Catholics, that you are not supposed to pay respect to ancestors. You are not supposed to take part in the rite. And the Kangxi Emperor, the emperor heard about this, and he met with the nuncio, and he pointed at the Chinese word on top of the court there, and said, can you read these words? And the nuncio said, no, I can't read Chinese. And said, now, you do not know anything about the Chinese culture. Don't come and tell us what we should do and what we should not do. It's a sad story, but we should learn from this mistake.
It was a ban only revoked as late as the 1930s. A sad story, but unfortunately the damage was done. And the ensuing result was a far cry from Ricci's illuminated thinking and understanding of Chinese culture. Let's read from his diary in this respect.
The work of evangelization, of making Christians, should be carried on both in Peking and in the provinces, following the methods of Pacific penetrations and cultural adaptations. Europeanism is to be shunned.
At this point, I thought I'd ask Father Lim how the figure of Ricci was viewed in China today. He shared with us his own experience in this regard. Given he's travelled extensively throughout this nation over the past 20 years or so.
I was quite surprised when I went to China for the past few years. And every time I went to China, I went to the bookstore to look for books written about the church, Christianity in China. And I found so many books written about Matteo Ricci. And they all have high praise for Matteo Ricci. The most important thing is Matteo Ricci came in to China with the kind of respect to the Chinese culture. He came as a friend. He really learned about the Chinese culture and try to speak to the Chinese way. And it's not like some, you know, missionaries, they like to use their own language and the sign, symbol of the Western culture. So I think that is very important why he was successful. Even today, he is so much respected. He came to China and he learned all about the Chinese culture.
You're a Jesuit yourself.
Yes.
In terms of Jesuit spirituality, would you say Ricci embodies the goals of the Society of Jesus? And if so, which of these in particular, in your opinion?
The way he tries to bring gospel to the Chinese people is very, very Jesuit way of doing it. Because St. Ignatius said that when you start a conversation with someone, you have to go through their door and come out through our door. That means you have to start with what they are interested in. Start with those things that they are interested in. And you talk about that, then lead them to Christ. You see, Matteo Ricci, he was trying to talk to people using their language rather than using his own language. Then lead them to Christ. And this is very Jesuit.
Looking outwards, can one affirm that Ricci introduced Chinese culture to the Western world?
Yes.
Stimulating, for example, Chinese studies in Europe?
Yes.
Is that so?
Yes. He was the one to translate so many of the Chinese classics into the Western language. He's been seen as a great figure, not only among the Catholics, also among the Chinese population, because even now in China, in some places, in a city, Nanchang, they built a big statue of Matteo Ricci in the park. So that's a great respect to him, because he was the one to bring the Western culture to China, and also from China to the West. You see, he was a bridge between these two, the two worlds.
A bridge between East and West. Four centuries on, the memory of Matteo Ricci to the Chinese Li Matu still lives on in China today. Li Matu, the Jesuit missionary, who, when he passed away, was survived by 2,500 Chinese Catholics. Among these, many from the educated classes, as well as 18 fellow Jesuits, half of whom were indigenous Chinese. And my thanks there go to the head of the Chinese program of Vatican Radio, Jesuit Father Emmanuel Lim. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this program. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.